Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the increasingly poisonous political discourse in the country that is likely to get worse as the 2016 elections approach. With a recent poll finding only 11% of Republicans think President Obama loves America. A question pollsters posed repeating the ugly statements from former New York City Mayor Giuliani that none of the Republican presidential candidates have distanced themselves from. Doug McAdam, a professor of sociology at Stanford University and author of Deeply Divided, Social Movements and Racial Politics in Postwar America, joins us to discuss the looming partial shutdown of the government over Obama's attempts at immigration reform and the apparent litmus test for presidential candidates to make it through the Republican primaries, where they have to reject the science of evolution and condone the dog whistle racist canard that Obama is not a real patriotic American who, as Giuliani charged, wasn't brought up the way you were brought up and I was brought up through love of this country. Then we will discuss President Obama's veto of the Republicans' Keystone XL pipeline bill, the third veto of his presidency, which he did in part to protect established executive branch prerogatives. But the fight is hardly over, as Senate Majority Leader McConnell vowed, "We are just getting started." Joining us is Connor Gibson, a member of Greenpeace's investigations team, who obtained documents exposing a prominent climate change denier, Willie Soon's financial ties to the Koch brothers, ExxonMobil, the Southern Company, and the American Petroleum Institute. We will examine the fossil fuel industry's role of denial and disinformation in selling the Keystone Pipeline and frustrating efforts to deal with climate change from global warming caused by methane and CO2. Then finally, we will look into the dramatic sea level rise along the northeast coast of America with the co-author of a new report that shows sea levels north of New York City rose by 128 millimeters in 2 years. Jianjun Yin, a professor of geosciences at the University of Arizona, whose research includes natural and anthropogenic climate change, sea level rise, and the ocean's role in climate change, joins us. And joining us now is Doug McAdam, who is a professor of sociology at Stanford University and a former director of the Center for Advanced Study in Behavioral Sciences. He is the co-author of The Origins of Our Fractured Society, Racial Politics and Social Movements in Postwar America, and Deeply Divided, Social Movements and Racial Politics in Postwar America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Doug McAdam.
Thanks, Ian.
And what do you make of the incredibly poisonous political atmosphere at the moment? It's been such for some time now, but lately it just appears, particularly with this peculiar outburst by former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani at a fundraiser for Scott Walker at the 21 Club in New York, where he basically said that President Obama is not a patriot, he doesn't love America, he's really not one of us, he wasn't brought up like we were. Pretty nasty sort of, you know, we've seen all of this rhetoric for some time, but it's sort of so brazen now. I'm just wondering, is there any way to check it, or is this just going to get worse? Is this an election year? Well, it's not the election year, but we know that we're in the beginning of the election season. So my assumption is that it's likely to get more heated as opposed to more modulated.
Yeah, I think I'm afraid I agree with you. It has been this way for some time. I mean, the level of divisiveness is really pretty unprecedented and has been really since, I'd say, the 2010 midterm elections that kind of brought the Tea Party kind of roaring to life in an electoral sense. And I certainly don't expect it to modulate anytime soon. You know, there's two issues. One is the one you mentioned. We're kind of gearing up. We're just in the early stages of the 2016 general election, and Republicans are kind of positioning themselves. The odd thing, though, I mean, I think Governor Walker has been doing that for some time in a kind of substantive sense, but he's clearly a serious candidate for the nomination. Rudy Giuliani is not. It's kind of an odd thing. So he's not positioning himself for anything. But again, this is what we've seen for some time now. Republicans, are deeply divided themselves. They're there is a real battle for kind of control over the party, and it kind of, and candidates or figures in the party kind of have to sort of play to the base, to the Tea Party base, as it were. But again, Giuliani's not a candidate, so I found that somewhat odd. In general, though, and forget the election, the Republicans are a overwhelmingly white party at this point. 90% of those who cast ballots for Romney in 2014 were white, as opposed to 60% of those who cast ballots for Obama. The Republican Party, you know, has a certain kind of demographic noose around its neck. We know that the country is diversifying at a rapid rate. The percentage of whites in the electorate is shrinking and will fall below 50%. I forget exactly when it is, 2030 or something like that. That noose is tightening, and you see Republicans in general kind of responding with some kind of fear about all these others, quote unquote, who are out there, racial minorities, gays, etc. And I've never really seen the Republican, not in my lifetime, I'm 63 years old, I've never seen the Republican Party this far to the right. And I think, again, Giuliani's comments, I just simply code in that general category. But again, he was speaking at a fundraiser for Governor Walker. So, you know, game on. We are into the election season.
Well, but Governor Walker, when asked whether he agreed with Giuliani's comments, that effectively said that Obama doesn't love America and he's not one of us. He's the other, as you just mentioned. He refused to answer that. He just tried to punt, which is what he did in London when he was asked whether he believes in evolution. And then subsequently, he was asked by the Washington Post a different question. Do you think that President Obama is a Christian? And again, Scott Walker wouldn't answer that. He tried to avoid it. He certainly didn't do the obvious thing, which was say yes. Because guess what? If he would have said yes, that he is a Christian, it wouldn't have been a story. I mean, what's wrong with this guy? I mean, he seems like...
He has been positioning himself, moving himself slowly to the right, I think, gearing up for the, you know, the bruising primary battles ahead. You know, he also has shifted his position quite significantly to the right on abortion. He previously had said he was pro-life, but, you know, found the issue very difficult morally, which of course it is. Apparently, in meetings with Republicans in Iowa, sort of looking forward to the caucus in January, or whenever it is, I think it's January, you know, he kind of refuted that and said he's in favor of an amendment, a personhood amendment that would define the beginning of life with conception, et cetera, and would mean that any form of abortion was essentially, would be counter to that amendment. So Governor Walker is clearly shifting his positions to the right. I thought that Jeb Bush really missed an opportunity to not sort of refute Giuliani's comments, to just step up and say, you know, he did not agree, but he's laid low. I think that's a mistake politically. That is, you know, it looks to me as if the path to the nomination for the Republicans is going to look very much in 2016, very much as it did in 2012. That is, you know, bruising sort of primary battles, and candidates will be pushed to move to the right because those who participate in the primaries and the caucuses tend to be, you know, the more extreme or Tea Party wing of the party. And so you get pushed in that direction. But if you kind of hold steady and move through the primaries, taking your shots, losing occasionally, but accumulating delegates and for the convention, I think the moderate centrist candidate, if we can use those terms advisedly, will come out of the primary process with the, you know, the clear path to the nomination. And then in the general election, you want to stay more as moderate as you can. Romney veered sharply to the right. I don't think that was credible to the Tea Party wing of the party when he tried to move back kind of in a centrist direction during the general election. I don't think that the general electorate believed it. I think you'd be much better off as a Republican candidate to simply try to hew to the center all the way through the process. And Jeb Bush could have started that positioning by simply calmly refuting Giuliani's remarks, but he chose to stay silent.
Again, I'm speaking with Doug McAdam, who's a professor of sociology at Stanford University and a former director of the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences. He is the author of Deeply Divided: Social Movements and Racial Politics in Postwar America. But the fact that the so-called moderate candidate in this, you know, there are about 20 Republicans running at this point, and there may be more, but he's certainly the front runner in terms of accruing money, Jeb Bush. The fact that he remained silent over this obviously disgraceful depiction of the president would indicate to me that Bush is relinquishing, as they all are, to this Republican primary litmus test. In other words, you have to be a creationist, you have to deny science, you have to deny evolution, you have to be sort of, you know, dog whistle racist in suggesting that Obama is the other, he's not a real American, and all of that poisonous stuff that's been out there for the longest time. I mean, this is what's so ugly about it. You know, you just think that some of these candidates would have some integrity. I remember John McCain, when he was running against Obama, a woman got up and basically said, you know, he's an Arab, he's not a Christian, talking about Obama. And McCain corrected her and said, no, he's a decent man, he's a good Christian and a family man and, a good American. You know, you just sort of yearn for somebody like that to step up and stop this poisonous garbage.
I couldn't agree more. I remember that moment, too, and even at the time, I thought that really showed a kind of an integrity, a courage, a strength of conviction on John McCain's part. It is worth remembering that was 2008, and it's before the Tea Party had emerged, and before that wing of the party was as strong and influential within the GOP as it has become. I'd like to think John McCain would, you know, behave in exactly that same way if he was in that situation now. But since the rise of the Tea Party in 2010, it's been a very rare Republican national figure who's been willing to kind of buck that trend. I think it doesn't make sense politically. I understand why there is a desire to move in that direction, especially as you gear up for the primaries and to remain silent, as Jeb Bush has in the wake of Giuliani's remarks. But I think it's a mistake. In 2012, there was a kind of Tea Party favorite of the month, and none of them ever really generated the momentum to challenge Romney and the huge money advantage he had. I think it's looking like that again. That is, there will be a number of candidates seeking support from the Tea Party, but at this point, it doesn't appear as if anybody's going to really become the Tea Party favorite and have the kind of resources to go head-to-head with someone like Jeb Bush. In my view, it would be better for Jeb Bush to kind of position himself. It wouldn't have to be. I mean, the Republican Party at this point, even moderates are conservative. So you don't have to go, you know, you don't have to be terribly moderate in your views on any of these major issues. But I think it would serve him well to distance himself somewhat from the extreme right of his party and begin to amass the support of the kind of moderate centrist elements within the party. Even if it again meant that, yeah, he'd take his knocks in some of the primaries, but continue to move forward and accumulate delegates as other candidates kind of ebbed and flow, their popularity ebbed and flow in the contest. But we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Well, Doug McAdam, it seemed to me, though, that what not only are these Republicans showing moral cowardice in not repudiating this kind of racist, poisonous nonsense that Giuliani spewed out, but much of this stuff, of course, has been generated by Fox News over the years. You know, the birther issue is entirely their creation. So it's little wonder that people like that woman who confronted John McCain referring to Obama as an Arab believes what they believe, because they might well watch Fox News. So is that a part of it, that none of these candidates want to really take on the basic propaganda machine that has created these poisonous false narratives?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think Fox News is certainly very powerful and is a big part of the story that you're quite right about that. I mean, that is a constant source of misinformation with respect to President Obama, for sure. And yes, those who are dependent for their news on Fox News will be forgiven for believing these untruths, because that's you know, they're disseminated constantly. I think really at this point that the candidates, who as they start to gear up for the primaries, are less concerned about Fox News, but they understand just what a gauntlet those primaries will be. Again, what we know about primary voters is that they are not representative of the general electorate, certainly, and they're not even representative of the voters in their party. You know, primaries are low turnout elections, and in low turnout elections, we get non-representative, more ideologically committed voters, and that's true in the Democratic primaries and in the Republicans as well. So the Republicans are, the candidates are sort of girding their loins, they're gearing up for what's going to be a bruising set of primary contests. And I think that's their principal worry, not Fox News at this point. If I could, we're talking about all sorts of negative stuff. I just want to insert it, you know, and I know you know this, and your viewers certainly know it as well. President Obama has professed his love for his country many, many, many times, most memorably maybe in his kind of coming out speech at the 2004 Democratic Convention, which kind of brought him into the national spotlight. It was a spectacular speech, and in it he simply told his story and said, you know, I'm a product of the American dream as well. Look at my circumstances, and you know, boy, do I consider myself lucky to have grown up in this great country that would allow someone with my background to be in the position I am in. So, I mean, he's professed his love for his country in many, many, many settings. It's quite remarkable to me that is forgotten. And the New York Times had a little piece today just going, oh, by the way, it wasn't on the editorial page. It was actually in the main section of the national news, just saying, oh, by the way, has he expressed love for his country? Yes, indeed. Here are a number of examples. So it's quite stunning.
Well, Fox News may not be the ultimate decider in terms of the Republican presidential primaries, but Rupert Murdoch certainly has already played a big hand. Supposedly, he's one of the main reasons why Romney decided not to run again. You know, Romney met with Jeb Bush, and Murdoch made it real clear that he was not going to he was going to fight tooth and nail and use his considerable resources to block any chances that Romney may have. And he's clear that he's decided who becomes Prime Minister of Australia, who becomes Prime Minister of Britain. He liked Tony Blair, then he didn't like him. You know, he's a kingmaker.
Yeah.
So that seems to have already happened. But I'm wondering, though, at the end of the day, whether the big money people in the Republican Party really count more than these grassroots radicals in the Tea Partiers. It's pretty clear the big money want Jeb Bush. Do you think at the end of the day they'll get their way in spite of this kind of grueling running the gauntlet of the primaries, where you're going to hug the right and then move back to the center after you get the nomination?
Yeah, I do. I think that I think a lot of the money, the big money in the Republican Party, actually was initially delighted with the kind of energy, the grassroots energy and fervor of the Tea Party, and initially, you know, maybe even backed some of those Tea Party candidates. I think the Republican establishment was also delighted by this kind of thunder on the right by the Tea Party as well. I think it wasn't until the government shut down. There have been enough of them. I can't even remember what fall. I think it was the fall of 2013. In any case, that the Republican establishment and some of the big money in the Republican Party started realizing that the interests of the Tea Party, the real right wing of the party, and the so-called party establishment really were not totally aligned. We're not terribly well aligned at all. And I think there's been an effort to try to kind of close ranks. More of that money, I think, has moved back in the direction of establishment candidates. I think the establishment in Congress now, the establishment types, have been able to bring the Tea Party caucus to heel a bit more, I say. There's still a struggle there. But I see evidence of a certain kind of consolidation of support, moving back in the direction, as I say, of the more establishment candidates, Jeb Bush being the prime example as we head into 2016. And the Tea Party, as powerful and influential as it is, it's not united. It doesn't have the capacity, I think, to line up behind a single candidate. And so I certainly think the advantage, as it was in 2012, for Romney is, that moderate centrist position and the money that it attracts. Let me add one other little strategic wrinkle, which I think is likely to be the key to the election, and that is the Hispanic vote. If Jeb Bush really moves to the right substantially in the primaries to try to appeal to the Tea Party wing, and for instance, were to kind of generally embrace the extreme position in the Republican Party on immigration reform, that the position, by the way, that has prevented any kind of serious immigration reform bill from getting out of Congress for the last 2 years, if he were to move in that direction, he really runs the risk of continuing to alienate Hispanic voters who in the last two general elections have voted 3-1 Democratic. If they vote 3-1 Democratic in 2016, the Democratic candidate will win. The Republicans to win really have to nudge that percentage back in a more competitive direction. 70% might even do it. And Bush is perfectly positioned to do it. He himself has had a relatively moderate position on the issue. He has a Hispanic wife, et cetera. This would be a mistake if he were to move, I think, too far to the right in his effort to appeal to the Tea Party crowd.
Well, just in closing, of course, that is the heart of this partial government shutdown that's being threatened on Friday.
Yes, yes.
Over funding the Department of Homeland Security, because the Republicans want to defund Obama's stopgap effort to do something about immigration reform in the face of Republican obstruction. And we'll see whether the Republicans are going to shoot themselves in the foot. I know McConnell's trying to separate those bills, have a clean bill, but I don't know that the House, they seem to really think they want to fight, and they seem to think that their base really feels so strongly about Obama's alleged overreach that they have to make this peculiar and suicidal stand. And then on the other point on Jeb Bush, the rumor is he's going to have Condoleezza Rice as his running mate. So he's definitely at some point or other got to man up here and somehow distinguish himself from the rest of the pack who are wallowing in poison.
Yep, I couldn't agree more. And you're absolutely right to bring up the Homeland Security mess, because again, at least the Republicans in Congress, certainly in the House, have reinforced their extreme position on this issue, which could cost them dearly in the election. And it'll be interesting to see if, in fact, there's a shutdown and it becomes the big public issue. It would, in that case, what Jeb Bush would say about the position that his colleagues in Congress have taken on the issue, and which would in the end result presumably in a shutdown of Homeland Security.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Doug McAdam.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Doug McAdam, who is a professor of sociology at Stanford University and a former director of the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences. He is the author of Deeply Divided: Social Movements and Racial Politics in Post-War America. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into President Obama's veto of the Republicans' Keystone XL pipeline bill. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Connor Gibson, a member of Greenpeace's investigations team, where he focuses on polluting industries and their front groups, PR firms, and political operatives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Connor Gibson.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And the president vetoed the Keystone pipeline. He doesn't issue too many vetoes, but he did that on Tuesday. And obviously, it will create an uproar amongst the proponents of the pipeline. But so much of the arguments about both the need for fossil fuels and that they don't affect climate change, which they clearly do, seem to be embodied in this recent expose by the New York Times of one of the prominent climate deniers, Willie Soon, at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, who now, according to the New York Times investigation, has been funded by the oil companies, a number of them, very prominent ones, Koch Industries, ExxonMobil, Southern Companies, etc. So is there a link then, do you think, between the propaganda that we get about the need for the Keystone Pipeline and that it's not going to be environmentally dangerous, which clearly the president doesn't agree with, and two, the idea that burning this dirty fuel is not going to affect climate change?
Well, Ian, the latter has certainly been discredited, no thanks to the work of researchers like Willie Soon, who have polluted the conversation on climate change rather than contributing to it. There's a complementary effort by these climate science deniers like Dr. Willie Soon, who are convincing the American people that there's doubt in the scientific community about the causes of climate change, which, of course, is dramatically mostly from fossil fuel burning, agriculture, and methane from things like fracking wells leaking. But then at the same time, the industry is also pushing a narrative that the only way we can put people to work is through the oil industry, and we need things like the Keystone XL pipeline. That's, of course, not true. We know that the lobbyists for the oil industry have vastly overblown the amount of jobs that Keystone XL will provide. Not to dismiss the need for jobs, but just the idea that that's the only option in order to put people to work, whereas the clean energy economy is very promising. Sector that is growing rapidly. Our development of solar and wind technology has been very rapid over the last few years. So it's a two-part strategy. Confuse the public and make them think there's not a problem, and at the same time, make them think that oil and coal are the way to go.
Well, specifically in the New York Times recent piece exposing corporate cash and oil company ties to this climate denier, Willie Soon, at the Harvard Smithsonian Center, Some of the documents were obtained by you at Greenpeace. So he's apparently accepted more than $1.2 million from the fossil fuel industry over the last decade while failing to disclose that conflict of interest in most of his scientific papers.
Right. There are a few layers of problems that our new round of documents about who is financing the work of Dr. Willie Soon. We've known since 2011 or even earlier that the American Petroleum Institute, which is the top lobbying consortium for companies like Exxon, Chevron, Shell, and BP. We knew Exxon was paying for Willie Soon's research. We knew the American Petroleum Institute was paying for Willie Soon's research. We knew that the billionaire Charles Koch was paying for Soon's research, as well as a coal-burning utility called Southern Company. What's new about this round of documents we just got, though, is the manner in which he was communicating with some of these company representatives. They were offering, quote, deliverables in the form of Willie Soon's research being used to influence Congress, to influence the Kansas state legislature when it was considering an attack on clean energy incentives. That brings up questions for Greenpeace about whether or not a nonprofit foundation like the Charles Koch Foundation was in violation of IRS law by directly financing work that was used to influence politics. At the same time, we're also curious if ExxonMobil misled Congress. They told Congress back in 2004 that they were not funding Dr. Soon's work, and then our records show that 2 months later, they started soliciting him to write papers casting doubt over human's role in causing climate change. So there's apparently a pattern of deception. And in addition to the examples I cited, Willie Soon has had at least 11 instances where he submitted his work to science journals, and he made no indication that he was being funded by coal utility companies or a petrochemical billionaire. And that's in violation of most of the guidelines of these science journals that ended up publishing his work. So the Smithsonian has a lot of questions to answer about its apparent complicity in advancing a lobbying campaign to misinform the public over something that big oil is interested in perpetuating.
So did Smithsonian get any money from Exxon? Did Willie Soon facilitate any payback for the Smithsonian? I mean, on the surface, it's a bit puzzling that an astrophysicist would be considered an expert on climate change.
Right, and in fact, it turns out that Willie Soon's degree actually isn't in astrophysics, it's in aerospace engineering. The reason why he is promoted as an astrophysicist, his main thesis is that the sun is responsible for temperature changes and not human activity. That has been widely discredited. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has studied it thoroughly. Scientists agree that human-caused CO2 emissions correlate much more closely with the patterns of temperature rise we're seeing than anything that the sun is doing. The awkward part for Smithsonian is that, as an institution, Smithsonian is not a climate change denial group. In fact, Willie Soon's boss has distanced himself from the position of Willie Soon's research. But at the same time, Smithsonian, in the documents that we uncovered, was totally happy to take money from ExxonMobil into their general operating fund and not just paying for Willie Soon's research. So that indicates there was some financial incentive for Smithsonian to keep housing Dr. Soon and the debunked research that he was cranking out on the dime of oil and coal companies.
And again, I'm speaking with Connor Gibson, who's a member of Greenpeace's investigations team, where he focuses on polluting industries and their front groups, PR firms, and political operatives. So in terms of what the liability then, I mean, it'd be great for one of these climate deniers who deny that they get money from oil companies when they basically whore themselves out and offer deliverables, as you say, from the documents that you've obtained that we can deliver for you. It would be very useful for this guy to be pilloried. I imagine the New York Times recent article exposing him doesn't do him much good. And I imagine that the documents that you've found, you'll continue to try and smoke him out a little bit here. But it would be very useful if the IRS took a stand, because there's been so much abuse of these so-called social welfare vehicles through which, you know, billionaires have been hiding their donations to the Republican Party, thanks to the Citizens United. What's your sense of how liable he is if some of this, his phony testimony, oil company paid so-called research ended up in congressional testimony, it was used by the Kochs, etc.? Just walk us through the possible backlash here.
Well, again, we're asking a question if there was a violation of IRS law. And the reason for that is Soon's lack of disclosure when his research funded by the Charles Koch Foundation, a nonprofit, wound up being used to influence testimony in the Kansas State House to repeal a renewable energy standard, a law that makes utilities provide more clean energy. At the same time, there were a number of other organizations like Americans for Prosperity, like the Beacon Hill Institute in Boston, that were also working in Kansas on the very same thing. They are funded by the Charles Koch Foundation, which is the same foundation funding Dr. Soon's research, including some of the research that he used in his testimony in the Kansas State House. On top of all of that, Koch Industries itself was also lobbying aggressively, directly, to weaken the clean energy incentives in Kansas. So all of those, you know, pieces of evidence bring the question of whether or not Koch violated its tax-exempt status with the IRS, which would be a huge, huge deal for the Charles Koch Foundation. It's an organization that gives out, you know, upwards of tens of millions of dollars every year to organizations that advance its political agenda. It ostensibly does these campaign bankrolling for educational purposes, and if it's shown that it's not necessarily educational but actually political influence that Koch is financing, that would bring up questions, I believe, about whether or not they violated IRS law.
Well, you know, it does, at least in terms of payback or retribution or justice here, at least in terms of the president vetoing the Keystone XL pipeline. That is an exercise of the presidential prerogatives. This veto is only the third of his presidency. Do you see that in that context, Connor, as somebody that's fighting back?
Well, I think it shows the president is siding with the science in this case instead of, you know, industry-funded manipulation of science, as we're seeing with Dr. Willie Soon. And thank God he did decide to veto this Keystone XL bill. We do not need to be incentivizing more tar sands development, one of the dirtiest, most polluting forms of oil on the planet, up in Alberta, Canada. Now, what's interesting is that this is hopefully an indication that President Obama will continue to side with the science, because as a president, he's done a lot of questionable things in terms of prioritizing climate change, like opening offshore drilling on the Atlantic coast, fast-tracking fracking. There's a lot of questions about what we're going to do about methane that's leaking from fracking wells that is a serious cause of global climate change. So it's encouraging that the president is vetoing unnecessary oil infrastructure that's only going to aggravate the problem, but he's going to have to step up in a number of other ways, including his proposed regulations on U.S. coal plants, including controls on methane that's leaking from fracking wells, and a number of other initiatives that we need. I mean, at this point, the scientific community is getting desperate enough that some scientists are calling for unproven technology in order to help mitigate global climate change. We're talking about geoengineering, things to actually try to physically manipulate our climate system through technology. So if that's the point of desperation where scientists are at, we need the president to be making decisions like he did today to veto the Keystone XL pipeline.
Well, I'm referring to, you know, him standing up or against, you know, this kind of misinformation about what an urgent need this is for America's energy needs, etc., at a time when the Saudis are dumping oil and oil prices are so low that Keystone oil is not even practical, neither is fracking anymore in terms of its, you know, it needs about $100 a barrel to be profitable, and it's way down, almost half of that now, even though the speculators are driving the price of gas back again. But what I was referring to was in the president's veto, he's basically saying here that because this act of Congress conflicts with established executive branch procedures and cuts short thorough investigation of issues that could bear on our national interest, including our security, safety, and environment, it has earned my veto. I mean, essentially, if he hadn't vetoed this, he would be losing the presidential prerogative, because it is a cross-border issue. The pipeline goes from Canada and the United States that requires executive branch review. So, I mean, there was more at stake than just the Keystone pipeline. There was essentially executive branch prerogatives at stake here.
Exactly. And when the president makes decisions like this, it sends a really important message to, you know, the banks and the industries that finance projects like this, too, that it is not a sound investment in the future to be sending your money to outdated 20th century energy infrastructure. Why don't we instead invest in, you know, American energy in the form of the sunlight that's hitting American roofs or the wind that's blowing through America's backyards? That's what I think we should be incentivizing, not regressive policies that continue to, you know, offer handouts to the most profitable industry on the planet that is intentionally manipulating the public understanding of a crisis like climate change, usually systematically and intentionally dismissing their role in instances of pollution, of air pollution, of water pollution, things that ultimately affect the health of people. So I hope that the president continues with his trajectory to prioritize the climate. Some additional steps he could take would be removing the billions in taxpayer handouts that are going to subsidize the oil industry. They don't need those subsidies, and we shouldn't be incentivizing energy that poisons us.
Well, there's no question that the battle is not over, and it's pretty clear that this Keystone Pipeline is really about getting this Canadian dirty oil down to the Texas refineries, where it's about the only place around that can process this heavy tar-like oil, which is similar to what comes from Venezuela. But the point is that they're going to, you know, basically sell this stuff abroad. There's a glut going on.
That's right.
In case you didn't notice. So the whole thing is a little bit surreal. But in terms of the bogus science, which is used both to sell the Keystone Pipeline and to deny climate change, this oil industry paid climate denier, Willie Soon, you said his bogus research was used by the Koch brothers to stop clean energy efforts in the state of Kansas. Were they successful?
They were not successful. To the shock of just about everybody, Kansas, a state that's deeply influenced by Koch Industries, which is based there, did not repeal its incentives for clean energy. And that had a lot to do with the success that it's had in providing revenue to farmers who are leasing their land to host wind turbines, remembering that these farmers are being impacted by climate change severely over the last few years through drought and other changing conditions that are messing with the weather patterns that they're used to relying upon. So, in fact, wind energy has been a bailout of sorts for farmers who are suffering from the effects of climate change. And that popularity among rural farmers and the people that have been paid and put to work developing clean energy infrastructure in Kansas, that ended up winning the day. The forces, the politicians, the Koch-funded front groups and the state policy network, groups like the American Legislative Exchange Council, known as ALEC, these groups will likely continue to attack Kansas's clean energy incentives in this year as part of a broader plan to mess up the Environmental Protection Agency's Clean Power Plan. And that is the rule I referred to, President Obama's rule to control carbon emissions from U.S. coal plants. It's critical that states like Kansas continue to give a lift to clean energy, which is, you know, decades behind the incentives that we've given to industries like coal and oil. And it's crucial that the president continue to tamp down on carbon emissions from the biggest sources like coal plants. So hopefully the Kochs will not get their way yet again if they try to attack Kansas clean energy laws.
Well, just in closing, Connor Gibson, since you somehow managed to get hold of these documents that show that this so-called climate scientist, who is, as you point out, is actually an aeronautical engineer, in effect posing as an astrophysicist, whose research has been thoroughly discredited by his peers. Nevertheless, he's been funded by Exxon and Koch Industries and the American Petroleum Institute and the Southern Company. You know, one of the sad things is, of course, on the other side, people who are trying to stand up for science and for facts, they don't get that kind of funding. But my understanding is that, at least according to the Boston Globe, that Senator Ed Markey plans on opening an investigation on climate science deniers. Clearly, the Democrats are in the minority in the Senate. And I think, is the Science Committee on the Senate now headed by the climate denier, Imhoff? Is he back in charge?
James Inhofe indeed is in a powerful position in the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, and he is the senator who infamously called climate change a hoax. In fact, Willie Soon was one of his guest people who testified in that very hearing, and that is one of the hearings that we are talking about there being a conflict of interest with Exxon's disclosure.
But will this happen? I mean, can the fact that he may have lied to Congress be brought out by Senator Markey? Will he get his day in court, as they say?
We're clearly getting a strong signal that there's interest in Congress in investigating this. Senator Markey has made it clear that he wants to know if these oil and coal companies and their lobbying associations are funding other scientists, that they're not disclosing that crucial link that the public needs to know if they're going to make an informed decision about, you know, how much to value information and where it's coming from. Also worth noting is that Representative Raul Grijalva of Arizona has written to several universities who are housing well-known climate change science deniers who have been paid by the industry in the past. And he, too, is trying to ask questions about the role these universities may be playing in making it appear like there's an intellectual framework against the massive evidence of climate change science. So stay tuned to see what Senator Markey digs up on these companies financed to climate deniers and what Representative Grijalva hears back from universities.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Connor Gibson.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Connor Gibson, who's a member of Greenpeace's investigative team, where he focuses on polluting industries and their front groups, PR firms, and political operatives. And he managed to get hold of documentation linking this so-called scientist, Willie Soon, to oil and coal company financing. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the dramatic sea level rise along the northeast coast of America. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jan Jun Yin, a professor of geosciences at the University of Arizona, where his research interests include natural and anthropogenic climate change, sea level rise, the ocean's role in climate and climate change, and Earth systems modeling. He is the co-author of a new paper about the dramatic sea level rise along the east coast of the U.S. that has been published by Geophysical Research Letters and the journal Nature Communications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jan Jun Yin.
Hello.
So tell me, Professor Yin, the fact that the sea level has risen so dramatically at a record level from 2009 to 2010 along the northeast coast of the United States, north of New York City, it's risen by 128 millimeters in 2 years, which is, that's a little over 5 inches, right?
Yeah.
So what are the factors here? Is this purely to do with climate change?
Actually, our study indicates that the extreme sea level rise event was closely related to a observed 30% downturn of the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation from 2009 to 2010. And also, the significant negative North Atlantic Oscillation Index in 2009-2010 also contributed to this extreme sea level rise event.
So what are the factors then, along with climate change? Are there any cyclical factors that would account for this that are on the historical record?
Our statistical analysis suggests that this event was a one in 850-year event based on the past record. So this event is very unusual.
And the point being, though, that as you've have indicated, when coastal storms occur, extreme sea levels can lead to an elevated storm surge. So 5 inches doesn't sound like a lot, but I take it you're saying it is a lot.
Yeah, so this is an interannual sea level rise event, so it's a lot.
And again, how unusual is that?
So this extreme event has not happened in the past century.
I see. And again, do you have a scientific link, or do you have to speculate about its cause?
So we did some analysis based on the observational data and the modeling data, and the our result indicates that it's the ocean circulation and the atmospheric variability responsible for this event.
So is there anywhere else on the planet where a similar dramatic rise in the sea level has taken place in such a short period of time?
We have not looked at other regions. So far, we focused on the east coast of the U.S.
I see. So there's no way of knowing that that this is just isolated, because you would think that if sea level rise is being caused by global warming, as 90-something percent of the scientific community believe, and as you know, Professor Yin, there are small Pacific islands that are basically going underwater, and a lot of these small Pacific nations are extremely concerned about the effects of global warming. But you would think that global warming would raise the oceans uniformly across the planet. Is that the case, or is that not the case?
Yeah, so global warming will cause global sea level rise. Actually, our study focuses on a interannual sea level rise case. So it's not the long-term gradual sea level rise. It's an interannual sea level rise event.
But you would have to add that to the long-term sea level rise, would you not?
Right. So actually, if the extreme sea level rise events are superimposed on the long-term gradual sea level rise, so and this event will occur more frequently in the future.
So as you know, Professor Yin, there are a minority of climate change deniers. And it's very, and we've just learned recently that one of the more prominent climate change deniers has been funded by a lot of the major oil companies. The New York Times just did an expose on this. How would you say that these findings relate to that debate? Or it's not really a debate in this country, but for some reason or other, even though you have 90-something percent of scientists saying that global warming is caused by human actions, the very small, well-funded minority still seems to get a lot of attention and still seems to frustrate and muddy the waters, so that studies like yours are not really made clear. Would you agree?
I think the IPCC assessment report concludes that the warming is happening and the human play an important role.
But would you agree that somehow or other we can't get past the idea that this is not conclusive?
I'm sorry?
Would you agree, though, that because of the amount of attention that the minority of deniers get, that somehow we can't get past this impasse where we can get on with accepting the reality rather than arguing about whether or not it's happening?
Actually, with time going on, I think the climate change signal will become more and more clear. So in the future. So I think the evidence will become stronger in the future.
Which is to say that the planet is more and more endangered in the future.
Yeah.
So are we at a point now where we would have to build dikes and dams, or is there anything else we can do? I mean, short of stopping the release of CO2, which there's not a lot of evidence that there's a global regime to do that, is there? There are lots of promises. The US and China made certain promises recently. India is also we're trying to negotiate with them, but I'm trying to get a sense from you as a scientist, at what point will there be a kind of concrete global program here?
I think we should reduce the CO2 emission in the future.
Uh-huh. And so just to get back to the idea that that you've had this record rise in the Northeast, sea level north of New York City, and that the next time that there's a surge and a storm surge on top of that, it's likely to cause. Do you think the next hurricane will be worse than Hurricane Sandy, which was pretty bad?
Yeah, with the global rise, global sea level rise, and also regional sea level rise, the future storms will become worse and worse.
So that would indicate then that we're past the point of you know, we that would indicate that we've reached the point where you have to build seawalls. Is that the only answer here?
I know some people made this suggestion.
Uh-huh. But is it really, from your position as a scientist, would you say that there's no other way around it, right? I mean, it's too late. And I take it that there's an awful lot of CO2 that's sort of making its way up into the atmosphere. So the amount of CO2 level is likely to rise before any practical methods of mitigation are taken.
Yeah, the sea level rise actually can respond to CO2 level in the atmosphere slowly. So the response time is very long.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, just in closing, what would your recommendations be to policymakers, Professor Yin, in terms of how they should respond to your study?
Actually, climate change will cause global sea level rise, and with the higher CO2 level in the atmosphere, we will see more and more extreme events, including sea level rise.
Well,
we should take action to reduce the CO2 emission.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Jianjun Yin.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Jianjun Yin, who's a professor of geosciences at the University of Arizona, where his research interests include natural and anthropogenic climate change, sea level rise, the ocean's role in climate and climate change, and Earth system modeling. He's the co-author of a new paper about the dramatic sea level rise along the east coast of the U.S. that has been published by Geophysical Research Letters and the journal Nature Communications. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.